or dollar mark or whatever. And if you eliminate the pulses that he's using, these are very rapidly pulsed systems, these plasmas are formed not in a gas or a vacuum or something, which is where plasma forms, but inside the crystal. And they exist. A Russian also had a notion on this, but never produced the things the way Austin did. They exist as a quasi-metal because there's nothing else there that's active except holding electrons. Okay, what he further found was that if you pulse these right, you could get a computer element, a logic switch out of this on and off, because when you produce this dense plasma of them, the conductivity went way up, so it was almost like a metal, like a wire there. You let them then diffuse down to, and they didn't have to diffuse any distance, you layer them with another wavelength of the laser, which catalyzes the recombination, and the thing becomes insulator. So it is the fastest switch. It's much faster than Josephson junction switches, which have been suited as a major thing. And someday we'll probably see computers and maybe even communication switches made of this. But it functions like a million to 10 million times a second, and that's a fast turnaround. So, but it is very important, and your recollection of this is very good, because this is one of the major logic breaks that anybody's had. We've been keep looking for these things. We keep looking for them, so that the conventional computer systems, and I can see you again. The conventional computer systems are really outpaced by this very strongly. This is quite a size, which has to do with one of these accurate identification of the appearance of a young physicist named Austin in a conference there. We got on to this by saying, well, how do we keep up with what people are doing, a few thousand of them, and these conferences where the individuals appear and talk about their work is how a lot of it happened, and you remembered a very good one.
Were the projects then, let's say, recommended by a department head and up the line that this particular person did a presentation?
Yes, although this was, and you again noticed in my council notes that this was delegated first to the appropriate vice president, who then went to the executive director, who then conferred on the director with the director, and then the department head had a very vital part in it of finding what the important things were, because this is a process not only of informing us, but forcing them to think about what was worth talking about, which they did very well.
So the department head really had a critical role in identifying.
Well, absolutely. The department head is the indispensable link, you see, between the frontier work and how it would get integrated into the organization and eventually into developmental action and life.
Okay, so we start then with, I think we'll come back to some of that in the last part of the interview today, but those are some of the issues that I wanted to raise when we talked about your administrative career.
Sure.
Are we all set to go, Martin? This is a continuation of an interview for the CHOP Oral History Program and the Bell Labs Archives Oral History Program with Dr. William O. Baker. And we're at the Mary Hill headquarters of AT&T Bell Labs today, June 18th, 1985. Last time, if you recall, we got up through your years at Princeton, you were joining Bell Labs, and began to talk about your encounters with C.S. Fuller, Stanley Morgan, some of your other early co-workers, and began to talk generally about the way in which Bell's polymer research was administered in the late 30s and early 40s. What I'd like to do is start by reviewing some of that and asking you a couple of questions that we didn't get to discuss last time. And let's start with this is the 1940 organization chart again. We talked about your relationship with Fuller and some of the other workers, but I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about Heiss and Norman Tate, I guess, is the other person you worked with. Since those were the people that you did some of your early publications out of the last list, and what role did the three of you play in those collaborations?
Let's get into this by recalling that this was the birth period of the solid state era, and we were probing in the Bell Laboratories how the chemical and physical and fundamental engineering resources could combine to introduce a new wave of discovery relevant to telecommunications and information handling as we came along. The chemical laboratories had already established a strong position in the study of dielectrics and of conductors. The whole vista of how synthetic materials could fit the new era that we aspired to for the Bell system and for telecommunications was in the process of formation. The point you make about how research missions could be supported by the staff was very central to how this program shaped up this new pre-war period, which, as we said, was stimulated by some of the work in Britain on solids and by growing interest in our own Department of Physics and the admirable work of Davison and Germer and others in the structure of solids and surfaces. Those resources involved a wide range of talents of people, and the new members of the staff were supported by skilled assistants, not ones who could be expected or were even interested in formulating the research programs themselves. Those were the challenges which the new recruits were given. We were not simply going to carry on what had been done, but we had better think of something new. But there were people, Heisen Tape were good examples of it, who knew the operations of the Bell laboratories, which were not altogether obvious, and the resources of the whole community were generally known to them in the traditions that the laboratories had already established. One of those was a very strong support staff in all sorts of ways, ranging from library, which is absolutely essential and fundamental, to shop work and the techniques of science, which you know so well, Jeff. The people that we started with, under Fuller's and Williams' general leadership, included Heiss and Pape, who were these very responsive, flexible, super technicians, assistants who would learn a particular method. Pape concentrated especially in X-rays, which we were diffracting furiously then. Heiss learned ballet. These folks were going to school at the same time, and they were very much urged to do that. Another long tradition in the Bell laboratories, but this was an early stage of it where we recognized their potentials, and they were urged to go to night school as much as we could really sustain them. It was just after the Depression, it really wasn't very far after. And so they were excited about learning chemistry and physics in this case, and certain bases of engineering. And that was a strong supporting element for their work with us. But you see, this is different than a university program where an individual is supposed to somehow acquire the necessary facilities and proceed from that point. Here, the whole Bell Laboratories was skillfully organized to provide the facilities so that we really went ahead from that stage.
So the first project that you worked on with Heisen Tape's help and with Fuller's, I hesitate to say direction, since you're obviously taking
leadership was a good word. Fuller was very good.
You started off studying using X-ray diffraction techniques to study the crystallinity of a plastic polymer, and then moved on from that to synthesizing a range of polyesters and polyamides, and then again using the same techniques to investigate the relationship between their chemical properties and their physical properties, or that is, their chemical structure and their physical properties. And I wonder if you could just talk a bit about that program, just so you could pick it up a little bit.
Sure. We are much stimulated by Brother's work at DuPont. pardon me, he had indicated that you could create a polymer, a synthetic insulating substance, which was chemically controlled and designed. Now, it was chemically controlled and designed in his sense by either ester linkages or amide linkages or combinations of both. We were much interested in ester linkages because the Bell system at that point, which was about the world's largest user of materials of one kind or other, had applied cellulose esters quite extensively, all the way from the origins of hi-fi recording, which were done on cellulose ester discs, to the insulation of a major portion of our wires and cables that way. So, here was an idea from Carruthers that said you could synthesize substances which had crystallinity, like cellulose did, which had properties far more versatile and controllable than cellulosics or than any other material that we've been able to identify up to then. The vinyls and vinyl esters were vaguely appearing. Polyethylene had just peaked up over the horizon from ICI and was quickly grabbed by us as the first very high quality, high frequency dielectric in cable and quasi electronic fuse was put in the Philadelphia to Washington, Baltimore to Washington cable. So here were the kinds of things that were looming up and Carruthers was struck fuller. He really recognized what the potentials were. Off we went. On the one hand, this is a point that Arthur made in connection with your original query too, Jeff. On the one hand, much closer to applications than any university department would want to be or would consider being, we had the youth values very much in mind from the very beginning. But on the other hand, unconstrained by any requirements technologically at that stage, we were urged to be scientific and to look at fundamentals, which was in the tradition of the discovery by Davison and Gemma of the wave nature of matter and of the quantum qualities of the electron, of the waves and particles combination in electrons, and was therefore very different than the straight synthetic position which the Europeans had applied to polymers. Mm-hmm. And it applied with quite some ingenuity in Geneva, in Germany, and of course in Britain.
One of the things I was struck by in the work that you did on the polyester, that series of papers on the polyesters and polyamides, and then looking at the connection between their various properties and degree of the number of amide groups in the molecule, and that just looking at trends in its properties, was the way in which you applied your experience working with SMART on dipolar interactions, and also what were relatively new ideas about hydrogen bonding at that time. And I just was curious to know how much Fuller and the others were cognizant of all the new developments in that area of chemistry.
I think Fuller was very alert to this. The others were less interested and less close. But you're quite right that in looking at the behavior of ester linkages and of dipoles in solids, we found we could translate that work. We had studied ester linkages with SMITE as well, of course. Mm-hmm. We could translate that to these materials of mechanical properties invaluable to communications to the Bell system, whether it was for insulating wires and cables or for making terminal blocks or a variety of other things. But it was tremendously exciting to find that you could transfer quite what were then the modern, rather startling dielectric and physical properties to polymers, to plastics, to things which people had normally felt were unmanageable pieces of junk which you used one way or another, but which you didn't really understand, you see. That was the tradition in that field. and even though some progress had been made with the solar investors. So I think they did, Fuller certainly did realize this issue. You see, polyethylene was emerging, and it became, of course, the most crucial synthetic material in the system for many years, and we'll come in a few minutes to the idea that it displaced lead as cable sheets, and really equipped the Bell system to move into, naturally, the post-war era of microwaves and of high volume communications. Okay, here it was before the war, leading up in Britain, and we recognize that these polymers, and this was not a thing that Clothers paid much attention to, but these polymers were remarkable combinations of polar and non-polar systems, that the polyesters had polyethylene-like contents. The dipoles were separated by a pure hydrocarbon element, which was purely linear, which was an aliphatic hydrocarbon that gave you a segment, which was just like the most ideal polyethylene. Then you came to a segment which was polar. In the case of polyesters, it was an ester polarity, it was a carbonyl polarity. In the case of polyamides, it was much more subtle. It had what were peptide linkages. They were known to be among the most exciting in bio systems. They did show hydrogen bonding. Pauling was beginning to touch on this, but really hadn't come out with his folded chains. But they had hydrogen bonding, which was very versatile. From our point of view, it showed that early conductivity, which remains one of the exciting features, that was taken up by GE a few years later and became the controlling element in their electric blankets. You probably didn't live through the period of electric blankets, which was supposed to modulate the agonies of humankind. But the control of these things was based on this discovery we made, Roger and I, of the hydrogen bonding based conductivity. The subsequent findings of polyamide properties, which we published in those years, were said to be, and are still said to be, the first control of solid state polymers that was technologically decisive. The fibers, DuPont came around and told us in a very short time that the fibers of their making of nylon were really dominated by the thermal setting, with thermally annealing, which we discovered and which we they then applied very extensively to the whole fiber and textile formation. It became very important for us because the hydrogen bonding, as now the Clothers did recognize this in a synthetic sense, the hydrogen bonding of the nylons that he synthesized caused the melting point and thermal stability for wire insulation, which was far better than anything the Bell system had found before. Before that, we were constrained, and in case of very fine wires, which were the essence of magnetic controls, which in turn paved the way for the modern era of telecommunications, to turmoil, which had been discovered as a insulator, not electrically, but thermally and mechanically, and as a corrosion protectant. By the Chinese, probably at least 2,000 years before, and possibly a little longer. So there was an enormous gap here, and tremendous change. The Bell system reflected the factories in Carnegie and the factories in Hawthorne and so forth, were the world's largest users of these tung oil formulations and natural product formulations when we started this work. So there was rather a change between most progressive American industry, which the rest of the world at that stage, used GE and Westinghouse, all the rest used the same things, and the systems we were studying here and that we were developing.
We at least some of my generation tends to forget that the world wasn't always made of plastic.
That's right. This was where a great big change occurred.
And you mentioned DuPont, but at the same, between the late 30s and the post-war period, there was a tremendous change in the fibers market. Fibers versus natural fibers, and here we have in telecommunications, there's also a tremendous change, which hasn't always been as visible in the public as fibers, at least this particular aspect of it. And I'm sure that as we begin to look across the board at other industries, this shift to synthetic materials was...
Well, yes, I'll give you an example. Tires, automobile tires, of course, became fairly popular. We'll get to this rubber era in a moment to war, but this was aside from that. Were terribly important for the whole progress of our economy, of course, and they were reinforced by fibers, by some form of cellulose. We found that both cellulose itself and cellulose triacetate, which eventually became the basis for the Sony's commercialization, RNL, that was a little later, but that was based on exactly the same phenomenon. We did the work and published the work, and Sony took it over very effectively. For the thermal annealing of cellulose and its derivatives, that vastly enhanced the strength and the yield point. Now, the interesting point was you could do this with cellulose itself. And this is where a couple of things came together. A man named Sisson at the Boyce Thompson Institute had done some very good work on the structure of cellulose, particularly plant crystalline systems as fibrils and the kind of linen flax cellulose, which is very heavily structured. Now, this was important to the system because we were also enormous users of cellulose for lots of things, but the tire industry was also dependent on it. What we found was that the hydrogen bonding in forms of rayon, which were being exploited then for tires, regenerated cellulose, could be vastly improved by certain treatments of solvents or swelling and solvating agents and thermal adjustments. And Sisson's work had forecast some of this because he found there were different levels of order in cellulose. Nobody knew what they were. What we found, which was invaluably derived from our point of view, we wouldn't have had been smart enough to think of it otherwise, from the work with Carruthers polymers, was that this was because of rotational disorders. And therefore, if you change the rotational disorder, the orientation around the cellulose axis, you change the whole structure of the solid, of the fiber. And this became applied in the tire business. It was the reason that many of our tires exhibited superior wear and properties. The modulus of the cellulose was increased by 30-40%. The tenacity was increased very significantly. So this is all by way of responding to your point that the era of plastics and fibers and polymers was in revolution at this stage.
It's intriguing to see how a relatively theoretical insight, namely the rotational disorder within a region of a long polymer chain, can lead to something so immediately practical.
Yes, that is certain, in that it benefited, I think it came because of the Bell Laboratories and Bell Systems' commitment to engineering, to technology. And these fellows, which you mentioned at the beginning, were very aware of this. Heiss and Tope and, of course, others in sort of group realized that we'd like to use these effects and use these findings, and they speeded up the application very strongly.
Could you tell us a little bit about Jaeger before we leave this?
Yes, Jaeger was and is still, I don't know, not too well, a fascinating talent in using very highly sophisticated measurement techniques for the characterization of matter. Now, these measurement techniques have been developed for telecommunications. A man named Shackleton, for example, who died only a few years ago, had a bridge, which was the best measurement for the high kilofactor region. Jaeger had engineering skills and feeling for electronics and for circuitry, which were just superb. And the notion of using that for measurements on solids as complicated as polymers were thought to be was absolutely revolutionary. He did it with very great precision. These circuits were important for later
circuitry in telecommunications. So you have the methods of communicating, you have the engineering and science of telephony joining with engineering and science of phones mm-hmm. in the form of Jaeger.
And also on that project, on the dielectric properties of the polyesters and polyamides, you did get some advice from Peter DeBye, didn't you?
Well, yes. We, of course, DeBye was our patron saint before I joined the lab. He, Smythe had worked with him, and he was the creator of the concept of modern dielectrics, which Faraday might have done if he had, had been born at a later time, but it was DeBye who did it. Then, as soon as DeBye came to his country, which was before the war, we established a link with him, which was very extraordinary for those times. The Bell laboratories in those times had a tradition of not having consultants, of not linking with academic people. This is a curious tradition that we think started with a man named Lockwood in, shortly after Dr. Bell discoveries of the phone and the formation of the system of the corporation, because they had a terrible fight about whether they should do research and development inside the telephone business or whether it should all be simply purchased and contracted for outside in the universities and in other laboratories perhaps. Well, the leaders of that period succeeded in deciding to set up their own resources and drove Lockwood out of business, actually. He lost. But I think the polarization that that produced then cut us away. They said, well, we're not going to have consultants of any kind because this will be a compromise. And they didn't. There was just one fellow in metallurgy over that whole early part of the century. And by the 30s, when this ferment was going on internationally about structured matter, and when Davison and Germer's discovery, of course, had revolutionized the university view of matter as well as the view in the Bell Laboratories, it was fascinating that there were no academic exchanges. So the acquisition of DeBye as a consultant, the involvement of DeBye in our basic studies was remarkable and exciting. He took to it. He was very interested in the work that Morgan had done. He wasn't much interested in polymers backstage. I think he only heard of them through us. He regarded them as rather barbaric. Anything that had anything much beyond hydrogen chloride, he had understood very fully, was regarded too complicated. But the DeBye changed and became very sympathetic, although he found it rather amusing, I think, the intensity of effort and enthusiasm we had for polymers. He nevertheless had enormous respect for Morgan's and Jaeger's work and for Jaeger's wonderful measurement techniques, which were applied to a lot of simpler molecules at that stage, the chlorinated hydrocarbons. But he would have thought, perhaps, Marzi, that the Bell system had a large role in the evolution of chlorinated aromatics, which are now regarded as one of the great threats of the world. We didn't get to them, we didn't get into any volume usage, so we are innocent on that. But we did learn, they're called halowax, and we learned how to use this in condensers, which were far better than just the paper condensers. Now, there's another point, Jeff, with about cellulose. We were the world's largest users, but all the rest of electrotechnology, all the power people and the telegraph people and everybody else, depended for their circuits on paper wound with foil in the condensers. And cellulose just happened to have a reasonable set of properties. Gordon knows that cellulose in the form of paper has been used for a lot of good things, but it just happened to have the electrical qualities that were absolutely essential for the circuitry of those times. We then improved that. Coleman, who's probably known to you, K-H-M-A-N, was a contemporary of Morgan, a very good physical chemist, did a lot of work on the addition of halogenated and other synthetic aromatics, which enhance still more these remarkable properties of paper, etc. That was a thing that Jaeger and Morgan had pursued very accurately and precisely, and DeBye was interested in that. But when we brought the polymers in, this shifted a lot of the activity because they had properties that were not only competitive on for physical properties with fibers, the film, the wire coatings and cable, but also did things for condensers as capacitors in circuitry, which is unique. So that's how Dubai picked up the whole scene.
Have you had personal contact with him while you were at Princeton?
Not significantly. I worshipped him from afar.
What did you